Alan Kring Productions presents the Illinois State Collegiate Compendium, Academic Lectures in Business and Economics. This is Business Finance, FIL 240, Section 3 for Spring Semester 2018. Lecture 21, delivered on April 11, 2018. The title of this lecture is Cost of Capital.
Today, the cost of capital. And I gave you the components, and I actually showed you the cost of capital, the weighted average cost of capital. Now, just as a beginning, though, talk about the markets briefly, and just make sure that you have this down like a science now. Ma'am, good day or bad day?
Bad day.
The volatility, you'll have a good day, and then you'll have a couple of bad days, and that's just going to be the way it is for the time being. Reputable financial publications are noting this volatility that is quite unusual, and it's going to stay that way for the time being. We have so many different things going on that impact financial markets. On the one hand, we have, of course, the political war in Washington, which is not usually going to cause too much turbulence in a market, in the markets. But when you add in the trade war that is building and seems to be everyone's playing chicken, but the problem is no one wants to be the chicken. And so we're on a collision course here on that. And then we also have a prospect that is beginning to show up, what is called a war premium, may start to show up. Interestingly, in the early days of a new conflict, markets tend to respond favorably to this. And right now we are on a collision course with a war in Syria, and that oftentimes will be favorable to a market. Unless it looks like we're walking into, right away, into a quagmire. Understand that in the early days of the war in Iraq, it was thought that it was going to be a cakewalk. We were going to just stomp the hell out of Saddam Hussein and the Sunni forces. It turned out it didn't work out that way. But at first it looked like it was going to be a cakewalk. We were going to get a bunch of assets. We were going to get control of oil fields. Stock markets responded favorably. It was only later that they realized this is a quagmire. It seems that this time, looking at a potential for us to become seriously involved in the Syrian conflict, that's not going to have, there's no upside to that. We don't see anything that positive that can come out of that one. So the markets are going to respond nervously to that engagement, especially if it begins to drain money from the U.S. Treasury and all of that. Uncertainty worries us. There are some in the markets who just love volatility. Normal investment people don't like volatility. We like stability. We like some degree of predictability, and that's something that's absent right now. As you can see, the NASDAQ went up and down and up and down, just really quickly to see. That was rather wild. That was a really crazy day. You had an upsurge and a down. The bulls came roaring back, and then the bears came in and smacked them around. Bulls and bears pretty much had it out there in the final hour of trading. I think this is the one day, but anyway, if you were to look at this over the year to date, you can see that there is considerable volatility. Now, remember that volatility is not the same as expected return risk. However, when you've got a large portfolio like the NASDAQ composite, all of those stocks, well, that's going to be probably a little bit more close to the volatility representing beta there. And then pulling back the horns a little bit, come on. Is there some reason this sucks? Okay, we'll just do it again. You want to be like that? Well, that certainly sucked. Okay, let's try this again. Finance.yahoo.com. Okay. Anyway, the big monster companies, as you can see, there wasn't much break above even for the day. It was kind of a drop down menus and all that stupid stuff. Okay. As you can see, for the day, there were the bulls had a bit of a run, and then the bears just smacked them. Bulls came back, but it was back and forth, but the bears won for the day. And that's going to be, there were going to be more down days than up days. Just the reality of it. Very quickly, and we'll have a look at the treasury yield just to see if there's anything spooky there. Treasury yield. Yields. Daily treasury yield. Okay. Having a quick look to see where we're sitting. See where the 7 to 10, it floated back up again. Went from 6 basis points, spread back up to 7 basis points. It's just going to go up and down, warn us, threaten us, but try to scare us, but it hasn't inverted. Can't call a recession. As a matter of fact, I might not be able to for another month or two. It could just float like that, driving us crazy. One way or the other. That's where the markets stand right now. And I'm going to let that go for a minute. I'm going to talk here a little bit about the weighted average cost of capital. And I'm going to show you something. It's an amazing little resource done by the New York University. And it hasn't been updated in a couple of months, but it's worth looking at, no question about it. But first, a couple of different ways that you can look at debt as far as its yield is concerned. There is, and you'll see this one in the book, the cost of debt. Now, this isn't the after-tax cost. This is the cost of debt. One way you could think of the cost of debt is to take the yield to maturity, the YTM, minus the probability of loss times the loss rate. This P is the probability of loss, and this is the loss rate. Let me explain this to you. I showed you this really early in the course. I'm just going to refresh you. Okay. Suppose that a company is in bankruptcy. It's dead now. Liquidation value. Suppose that we've liquidated the company. Now the shareholders are going to get nothing. They're gone. We've got a liquidation value, let's say, of $100 million. And here is the debt structure. Debt type. Balance outstanding. Suppose that the senior, the highest bonds, there are $60 million owed in senior bonds. In senior subordinated, there are 10 million. Then in juniors, $35 million, and then junior support and junior subordinateds, there is another $10 million. Okay, so now here's what I mean by loss rate. First thing, they've liquidated the company. First folks that are going to get paid are those seniors, the senior debt. Now, the senior debt is going to get its. And if you look here, the seniors will get paid off. And so there will be the 100,000 minus the 60,000, so the 60 million, minus 100 million minus 60 million. So, there will be $40 million left over. So, the loss rate for the seniors would be zero. And the probability, we just assess that another way. But the loss rate for the seniors, maybe, would be zero. There's going to be no loss. Now, the senior subordinateds, well, they're going to get their $10 million. So their loss rate is going to be zero. And then the juniors, they're going to get $30 million. So they lose $5 million. So their loss rate would be $5 million. Of $35 million. Which would come out to be what, about 0.14? So their loss rate is 14%, 0.14. And their probability of a loss in this company is 100%. You see that? Because there's no doubt they're going to lose here. There's no doubt. And then these poor suckers down here, the junior subordinates, they get nothing. So their loss rate is 10 million over 10 million. The junior subordinateds, 10 over 10. There's a 100% loss rate and a probability of 100% on a loss rate on those suckers. Now, what does this mean in practice? Unless you're playing with companies that are at risk, I mean, you can do this calculation, but if I've got a AAA bond, why am I even going to worry about this kind of thing? If it's a sound, safe company, I'm just going to take yield to maturity. Only if there is some worry that it could get hurt do I begin to look at this kind of thing. Like, for example, think about those ones. Remember in that first exam I showed you those clear channel bonds? Those were definitely going to have losses. And I could go through and figure out what's the probability. It was a very high probability. Even when you saw that, it was a high probability. As it turned out, like the week after I gave you that test, you saw those, the company did go bankrupt. So even at that point when I showed you those, the probability was probably around 0.95, 95% chance that it was going to go belly up. And so we could begin to talk about probability of loss times the amount of the loss. The case, the truth of the matter is, all those bonds. I don't recall, but I think the one that you saw, the one at the top of those two, and there was an iHeart in there too, the company that it became. But I think that one at the top was the senior one. So they'd get first dibs, but they were going to lose money. They were probably going to lose half of what they were owed. And the probability at 95% when you saw that. So the yield to maturity was going to have some serious problems. Okay, now, another thing to consider. And again, this matters only, you can do the calculation, but it really matters only in some companies, is that we can sometimes talk about the net debt. Remember debt to equity? Or debt, the weight of debt is the debt over the debt plus equity, and the weight of equity is the equity over the debt plus equity. And I talked to you about equity. You should probably take the market cap for that guy. A similar thing that can be done is to say, all right, let's not look at the long-term debt itself. Let's look at the debt that we actually see, minus cash and marketable securities. In other words, if a company goes bankrupt, the debt holders, the first thing they're going to do is seize the cash accounts. So in other words, if there's cash, the debt holders, that's really not even debt because they're guaranteed they're going to get that. So in a way, like if you have a company that's got $10 billion in debt, and they have $2 billion in cash. Well, I'm not going to use the 10. I'm going to use 10 minus 2 because if they really did go belly up, well, those debt holders are going to freeze those bank accounts instantly. They'll go right to the court, freeze the bank accounts, nothing comes out of them. And so they aren't exposed $10 billion. They're exposed only $8 billion. Now, this is kind of important because if you remember, I talked to you about Netflix. They borrowed, I think it was $1.1 billion in notes payable. And then they just sat on it. It was parked there in their cash. As a matter of fact, I can even show you that little sucker, I think, fairly quickly. SEC.gov. Pull this up very quickly for you. Filings, company filings, NFLX. Really? Okay. Come on. Financial statements, consolidated balance sheets. I mean, look at this. Even at the end of 2007, their fiscal year is their calendar year. Look at all the long-term debt they have here. See that? Almost $6.5 billion in long-term debt. But they've got almost $3 billion of their... At the end of last year, they had almost $3 billion of that sitting in cash. So if Netflix did go belly up for some reason, just instantly, it went bankrupt, then the debt holders are going to seize that $3 billion. So realistically, in real life, I mean, they're really not, the debt value of the company right now is not $6.5 billion. Well, at the end of 2017, isn't $6.5 billion. Is probably more like about $3.6 billion. because of all that cash. Now, is that important? Well, in Netflix, yeah. I mean, most companies are not crazy enough to have that much liquidity. Do you see why that worries investment analysts like me? All of that liquidity, that's almost $3 billion that's earning nothing. Netflix is just sitting on it, waiting for something to happen. It's like, well, I can't criticize. You know, sometimes I'll keep way too much cash in my pocket because there might be a coupon in the mail for 10 for the price of 3 at Chick-fil-A. But other than that, I want you to appreciate that Netflix is where you probably would want to do that calculation for the debt. But in normal companies, I mean, you look at most normal companies, the cash is not going to be that much. So it really doesn't make that much of a difference in the end. But when you got some madness like this, I mean, I just keep staring at that. That's just extraordinary. In some ways, that's almost, look at how it jumped too. From fiscal 2016 to fiscal 2017, that jumped by almost 100%, that cash. And their long-term debt jumped by almost 100%. They put all that, they borrowed money at interest rate and they put it into a cash account that's earning them nothing. A whole year, they were building and multiplying by double the amount of cash that earns nothing by borrowing money that they have to pay something for. And the question would be, in a typical analyst's mind, not in my cynical mind, I'd say, if they don't do something, if I look at the second quarter of 2018 and this situation is still parked there like this, that's a sell. I mean, Netflix is showing clear, unambiguous signs of bad cash, bad management. If they're just waiting and waiting for something to happen, well, you know, maybe they'll find the deal of the century, who knows. But right now, that's not a very good thing. But again, this is unusual. So the net debt isn't going to make that much difference for a normal company. For these crazy mofos, though, you know, whatever, and all that kind of stuff. Let me tell you, when you see a beta, the beta that you see on Yahoo Finance is an equity beta. It's a beta of the stock. Now, debt has a beta too. Your bonds will carry their own beta. I see the stock of Netflix has a beta. Well, the bonds of Netflix would have their own beta. So what are the numbers? Now, the ones that are in the textbook might be a little bit more recent than the ones that I've got. But so I rely on those, not on mine. But I'll just—they're not going to be much different. But anything that is above an A rating, you know, what we would call truly investment grade, it's going to have a beta of 0.05 or less, 0.03, 0.04, 0.05. They are very low. Bonds are so boring. Remember I told you that the bond market is 10 times the size of the stock market? But no one talks about the bond market. Well, yes, let's talk today about the bond market and how exciting it is. Oh, it's not exciting. It's like the difference between using a jet ski and a rowboat. It's literally I can get creative, but I don't think I could even be a talking head and make bonds an exciting topic on a financial news show. They're just so boring. They're so dull, so unvolatile. Now, anything in the B range is going to have a beta of about 0.10, okay? So anything in the B range is going to have a beta of about 0.1. Again, ridiculous. Now, what really will blow you away? Interestingly, when you get to from BBB to BB, you go from a 0.10 to a 0.17. So double B are 70%, have 70% more non-diversifiable risk than triple Bs. And it accelerates. Single Bs have a beta of around, and again, my numbers might not be as recent as the books, but single Bs have about a 0.25. And triple Cs, the very highest of the junk bonds, the safest of the junk bonds, if there's such a thing, you're going to see betas around 0.3 on those. So even when you get to junk bonds, they are very boring. You could throw junk bonds into a portfolio. They're not going to make the portfolio's overall beta go crazy. Now, interestingly enough, the other side of that is the term to maturity. The term to maturity on the bonds. Let me show you this. Where did I put my... Oh, there they are. My rags. Okay. Let me show you this real quick here. Beta is also affected by the term of the bond, too. So, for example, if I put term here, in other words, how long the bond has left, 1 to 5 years, 5 to 10. Now, I broke this down. I did this, 10 to 15. If you look at it in terms of term and look at the beta, something like that. No, that's not right. That should be about 0.14. In other words, bonds that are close to maturity, in other words, they have 1 to 5 years left on the life of the bond, their betas are ludicrously low. They are virtually, as long as they're BBB, I should point out, this is for triple Bs or above. If it's triple B or above, and it's got anywhere from 1 to 5 years left on it, thing's going to have a beta of about 0.01. In other words, it's almost as safe as a treasury bill. Which is kind of interesting. Weren't those clear channel bonds very close to maturity? I'm trying to remember. But they were still highly non-volatile. They were just quiet because they were going to die. Now, some people, for example, you, sir, when you die, you're going to make a big fuss, okay? You're going to raise holy hell. You're a stock. You, madam, when you're going to die, you're going to do it with dignity. You're going to just go quietly. You're a bond. So, in other words, even bonds that are junk are going to die quietly. They're not going to suddenly become highly volatile instruments. They're just going to sink away and die. So anyway, but the only time you really get much in the way of beta and it's quiet, even at that, are the long bonds, where their prices can have some volatility because of interest rate uncertainty. The maturity premium can cause the bond to whipsaw some more, which is what we're seeing now, interestingly enough. If you look, and these numbers are actually kind of a little old, but I was looking at some bonds that were in the 20 to 30 year range, fairly high quality, A rating, I think A and double A. In the past few months, their betas have actually gotten up into the 0.25 range, because there's interest rate volatility, uncertainty, which causes the bond's price to go up and down as news comes in, news is discarded about what's about to happen. But anyway, enough of that. I want to show you something here. Okay. Yeah. Yes. The term is approaching zero.
Yeah. Once you're closer to that, you're closer to the date where you have to pay back the tithe.
Yes.
Doesn't that make it like riskier?
No, because almost all bond agreements, they years before, they had already squirreled away enough money. The rule is, I mean, the bond covenants will say, if you got a 30-year bond, within 10 to 15 years, there is enough in a fund to pay that bond off, and that can't be touched by anything else. That's a good point, though.
So if trouble came up, it would have been a lot earlier. Like that's
you better believe it. Absolutely. And that's another thing, too. When you're getting... You have a lot of years left in your life, sir. Okay? I expect that there's probably a higher probability that you're going to get in trouble, that you're going to do insane things, crazy things. You're going to do one of those things like a ghost pepper eating challenge or something like that, or do one of those weird new things they're doing with that snorting thing I saw on YouTube. That was just absolutely, my God. What is the matter with you millennials? Seriously, the Tide Pods were bad enough. And the cinnamon challenge, don't even talk to me about that. I tried it. I kid you not. It was, I thought, I'm a man, I'll just get one of those big scoops. I mean, it took me days to get the cinnamon out of my face. But anyway, but when you get old, I mean, you're near the end of your life. You're not going to probably do anything absolutely crazy. Although there are some people near the end of their lives, there was that guy who decided he was going to parachute out of an airplane at the age of 87. You know, that was pretty cool, except he didn't pack his parachute properly, and so it got even cooler. He had his reserve, though. But boy, that put some spring in his step. Anyway, I'm going to show you something. This is actually... At New York University, there is a sort of different universities do different things as far as research goes. Some universities, all they ever do is research that hardly anyone's ever going to read. And it frustrates me when I see those kinds of articles. Well, that's interesting, and maybe in 100 years, someone will pick it up and notice there was something useful about it. There's a story about that. Back in the 1800s, in the late 1800s, a mathematician, just a pure genius, he was so abstract, he decided to work out the mathematics of knots. He wrote a set of mathematical equations that for any knot that could be made. It was the stupidest, most useless research you would ever want to see. Until about 10 years ago, when they found out when a virus gets into DNA, we can't see it during the attack. But when it's finished, we can see what it does. It always knots up the DNA of its host. And turned out this guy's mathematics explains how it's doing it. So sometimes arcane research is useful. But what I really like are these research institutes at some schools where they actually collect real data and then they publish it for the rest of us so we don't have to. New York University has a very cool setup. This, what you're seeing here is by industry. How many companies there are that were sampled for it? The betas. Look at this, the cost of equity, the weight of equity. In other words, the E over D plus E, the standard deviation of the stock price, the cost of debt, the weight of debt, the after-tax cost of debt. And then, I'll be darned, The weighted average cost of capital in the local currency, in other words, if this is an industry overseas, but more importantly, in our currency. That's the WACC. They calculate it by industry so we don't have to. But take it over here just for a minute and look at the betas, just so you can see the real life. What if you were thinking of, well, I want to invest in a certain industry. Well, what kind of a beta exposure would you have? Can you see that very well? I can expand that. Let me do that a little bit. There. Now, at the point where this was done, about 2 months ago, the projected inflation rate, which is used for some of the calculations, was 1.90%. We have nudged that up now because we do see inflationary pressures, but we also see the Fed acting on those. So that's still not a bad estimate. So anyway, advertising, the beta. Notice that a lot of these have betas that are very low. But if you go down the list, and I'm just going to roll down here for a minute, tell me if you see anything that is a very high beta to start with. Ouch. Isn't that interesting? Steel, I think that is the highest one, isn't it? Really? I didn't catch that one. I just quickly looked at this data. You're right. Chemical. Interesting. Sometimes you can explain the beta. Sometimes it's just like, well, I got nothing. Like, for example, if you look at low betas, you'll see, okay, cable TV is under one. Primarily because, okay, let's try this. Why would that be relatively safe? Madam, can you give up cable TV forever? Yes, no, probably not, you know. Could you give up your cable? You don't have... For some reason, that actually, that makes sense. But God bless you, you know. But you, sir, and you, how could you possibly Netflix and chill if you don't have Netflix, huh?
I don't know.
No, seriously. You see, that's almost like a necessity of life now. I mean, it's almost like a human right. I mean, they can take away any freedom they want of ours, but if they take away our cable, we will go into full revolution. So there is, that's a sort of like a pass. But if you look down here, and there are a couple that are even, environmental and waste services. Again, these have become absolutely necessary because of law. If you don't do these kinds of things and hire the services of the companies that do this, you are not going to get by with it. And of course, as far as municipalities go, if they don't have waste management, the people would just have a fit. So it becomes one of those basic necessities of life. And then, of course, you get things like financial services. Try this. Do you know anyone over the age of 18 who doesn't have a bank account? No, I mean, you have to. They don't even pay with checks. It was hard for people like me when they started telling us that we had to have a bank so they could do direct deposit. They wouldn't give us a check anymore. That ruined my life. And as a matter of fact, I was upset when they started paying us in checks instead of cash in an envelope. God, that ages me thinking about that. But there again, there's one of those that's absolutely, it becomes more of a staple of life kind of industry. And those will tend to have lower betas. Look at the next one, farming agriculture. If we don't have the farms and the ag, we are all going to starve. Well, I won't because I'll just go to Red Robin and get a sandwich. But I guess there's something connected in there to food processing. Notice that these food things, that one's a little bit interesting to me. Home furnishing, that's got a low beta, almost indicating that that's become sort of a necessity. Well, I suppose, you know, for me, a couple of wooden crates and for a table and all, but okay, now let me pull down here just a little farther. Interestingly, household products hits the nail on the head. It is its volatility, the volatility of that industry's stocks, on average, is exactly the market's. So you can look through and you can see some interesting things. And I'll put up a link to this Excel sheet for you so that on my podcasting site. And it's actually not that bad to have that around. If you've got to do a research paper, you can just pull up this data and you've got a strong case for talking about the risk of an industry and all that kind of stuff. But there was one other one I wanted to find. Well, packaging and containers. Oh, look at this. See the power? Madam, could you live without electricity? I couldn't either. I mean, how would I ever make my electric fence work that keeps the squirrels away from my bird feeder? Do you know how much I hate those squirrels? They eat all of my... Anyway, so you see that the betas kind of go down as you were talking about things that are necessities of life. And then from there, now there was one, oil and gas. I'm just curious about that one because I can't remember what it was. Ooh, that's an interest. Oh, oil and gas distribution. Why are those betas higher? Those are massive. We're talking about massive companies in one of the largest industries of all on Earth. Why are those volatile? Why is the beta so high? It got a guess? Any guess? Say it. Well, the prices aren't guaranteed, and there's so much volatility, and there's so much vulnerability to global risk in that business. That's where it comes, is that, yeah, it's a necessity. Hydrocarbons drive our world. And quite honestly, even though we really do have to move on and get rid of fossil fuels, it's time. Whether there's global warming or not, we've got to grow up and move on to a new technology. But at the same time, the reality is that we're still going to have mostly internal combustion engines driven by hydrocarbons until the end of the century. Probably into the next century, there will still be a lot of gasoline-powered engines and things like that. So that global security risk is going to be there. And as long as the Middle East is a powder keg, and as long as those massive oil fields in Eastern Europe are in a danger zone between the Russians and the Chinese and the Western Europeans, we're going to have a lot of volatility in the prices and therefore in the supply chains on those. Moving down here, there was still... Someday I wish I had the time to explain to you what REITs are. They're so cool, but they have been turned into such an wild thing. Reinsurance, absolute necessity anymore. Restaurants and dining. Have you ever been to a restaurant, sir?
Yep.
You have? Mm-hmm. Really? You make your own food all the time, or do you like to go to a restaurant?
I like to go to a restaurant.
Seriously, I do too. I mean, the point there being that, interestingly, did you know that this, where we are right now, has the highest per capita restaurant usage in the United States? Here, for some reason, on a per capita basis, we spend more money in restaurants than any other place in the United States, which is kind of weird. I don't know why that is, but I mean, you know, people go to, I don't know, maybe people suck at cooking or something. I don't know. But anyway, just very quickly, going back down, there's still one that I, and I'm not going to see it right off the top of my head. But Oh, there it is. Utilities. See how low they are? Could you do without water? No. Could you do without your gas that drives your heater and all of that? No. You see, those are absolutely amazing how important they are. Now, one last thing. Notice that they give you the total market beta. Well, shock me, it's a 1.00. And which is actually kind of comforting. If you were to add up these betas by the weight of each industry, weighted average of all the betas in this list, and by the weight of each one in the total of the list as far as its market capitalization goes, you would find that it comes out to be smack dead on to a beta of 1.00. In other words, we are actually looking at the full components of the market portfolio. It's right here. We're looking right at it. Now, interestingly enough, there is an interest in taking out the financial sector. And the question would be, why would you take that out? Why would you be interested in seeing the beta without the financial sector in it? Is there some logic to that, or is that just a joke? Got anything?
Not sure.
The best way to explain it is that I am not necessary to your life, to the fundamental functioning of your life. A financial service is not the basis of the world. What I do, what accountants do, we are not going to save lives. We're not going to invent the next wonderful thing to take us to another planet. We're not going to be the ones who solve the long-term energy crisis or the global climate change crisis. We're not going to do that. We are not fundamental to the world. And so when you take us out of it, and that hurts my feelings. It really does. But if you take that out, interestingly enough, the world market portfolio without the financial services sector shows evidence of being a more volatile animal than it does with the financial services in there. There's almost a mystical side to that. We're not necessary, but what we do is we tame the world in our own way. Because if anything can guarantee that you will have wars and that you will end wars, it's finance. It's our financial services. We can create wars and we can justify them financially, and then we can also justify why we suddenly find reasons to be at peace. So there's a little bit of philosophy in there, but be cautious. Again, though, I'm going to give you the... let me show you something here real quick. The weighted average cost of capital. Oh, shoot. I want to lock this cell. Okay. Really? I used to be able to lock that. I know what I'll do. I'm going to hide a couple of where's the hide anymore on this? Right click. Right?
Yeah, you select everything right click.
Oh, there it is. Duh, I didn't see it there. Okay. So, cost of capital. Notice that the weighted average cost of capital is not necessarily related to the beta. Do you see that aerospace has a higher beta? Advertising has a higher beta than aerospace defense, but it has a lower cost of capital. So that's an interesting thing to keep in mind, that sometimes It's look down through here. But there is a relationship. It's just not a perfect relationship. So, for example, you've got banking centers. At a 0.64, they have a very low weighted average cost of capital. Beverage at a 1.33 beta does have a higher weighted average cost of capital. So clearly, there is a relationship, but it's not a perfect relationship. Now, I want to show you one other thing before I move on to another topic here. I'm going to unhide these. And then what I'm going to do is I'm going to find the capital structure. Okay, I want to get rid of this one. And I want to get rid of this. Get rid of standard deviation, although that's a nice one to have around. And then the cost of equity and the number of firms. Hide. Now, I want to get rid of that one too. Hide. Okay, so look. Right there is the capital structure by industry. See it? There's your weight of equity, your weight of debt. Notice that they add up to be 100%. Just what I've been showing you. Here it is. And you notice that it is all over the board. So, for example, advertising is relatively balanced, a little more equity than debt in the capital structure. But aerospace is heavily an equity industry. Debt is not a big part of the aerospace industry. But notice how, apparel, heavily leaning toward equity for long-term financing instead of debt. Auto and truck is the other way. But there were a couple here that were striking. What I was looking for. Beverages are heavily equity. There it is. There's one. Brokerage and investment firms. They are highly leveraged. In other words, they use a lot of debt in their capital structure. And there was two other ones I want to bring up just really quick. Oh, here it is. Financial services, another finance sector. Heavily debt, OPM, in other words, other people's money, drives that industry. Going down, I think that was the one that was the big one I wanted to show you, is that things in the financial sector are actually quite heavily leveraged. But a lot of firms, notice something, by the way, is that most firms use more equity than debt. Even though debt starts off cheaper than equity, especially on an after-tax basis, most industries still use more equity, even though it can be more expensive, than they use debt. And then one other thing, really quickly. The total market overall, and if you take the financial services sector out, which we saw was heavily leveraged, it is clear that the world markets use more equity than they use debt in their capital structure. That's just how it works. There is more ownership than there is owership, as we say, in the world markets. And interestingly enough, that has not changed too much over the. I've been tracking this table for the last 10 years or so. Hasn't changed much at all. In other words, there's not a trend toward debt. There's not a trend toward equity. It's a very stable. In other words, if we were going to look at the entire world as a single company, and we were to look at its weighted average cost of capital curve, what that's showing us and the percent of debt. %debt, 20%, 30%, 40%, 50%, 60%, 70%, 80%, 90%, 100% debt. and this is 50% debt. If we were to look at the entire world's weighted average cost of capital, like we are one giant firm, what we would see is that whatever else the shape of the curve has, 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, 9, 10. Whatever else we see, the weighted average cost of capital curve looks like that. That's the world as a single corporation. In other words, the bottoming out point, the optimal capital structure of Planet Earth Incorporated looks like that. It bottoms out. The optimal capital structure is at 23.5% debt and 76.5% equity. That's the optimal capital structure of the world. And all of those industries in it, each one contributes to the overall envelope that you see there. Kind of an interesting thing to think about, though. We can actually see the world as a single enterprise. Just kind of an interesting thing. Okay, now that's enough of that. I'm going to give you a quiz and then let you be on your way.